and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 29th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. In today's show, the focus is on population to go along with this week's special issue of Science.
We'll also have our usual wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
The world's human population is expected to click past the 7 billion mark this year, and could, according to some projections, reach 9 billion by 2050. That growth raises a wealth of issues related to care of the aging, employment of the young, environmental preservation, the rapid expansion of the developing world at the expense of the developed one, that form the theme of a special section in this week's Science. David Bloom, an economist and demographer at Harvard's School of Public Health, writes in that section that the world is in the midst of the greatest demographic upheaval in human history. I asked him about what lay behind that upheaval. He said the first component was the sheer rapid rise of global population itself.
It took over 50,000 years to reach a global population of 1 billion people. The human race did that about 200 years ago. And now, since 1960, what we've been doing is adding successive billions every decade or two. So world population hit 3 billion in 1960. It went to 6 billion around the year 2000. It's scheduled to reach 7 billion on October 31st of this year, and it's projected to reach a whopping 9.3 billion by the year 2050. The second aspect of demographic upheaval, I would say, has to do with human longevity. So for most of human history, the average person lived to about 30 years. But between 1950 and 2000, life expectancy increased by two decades. That's all people, all countries. And it's projected to increase by another decade between now and the year 2050. That is a truly astonishing human achievement. And to those two aspects of demographic upheaval, I would add a third, which has to do with the fall in fertility rates. So in 1950, the average woman in the world had five children over the course of her childbearing years. Today, the average woman has only 2.5 children. That is another phenomenal change with all sorts of transformational social and economic implications.
Well, let's explore some of those themes in a bit more detail, starting with growing population. Population obviously is expanding, given the numbers that you said. But one of the things you noted in your review, and I like the way you put this, is that the demographic center of gravity is shifting from the developed to the developing world. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Sure. The UN classifies certain regions as less developed. And in 1950, those regions encompassed 68% of the world's population. Today, those regions represent 82% of the world population. And that share is going to continue to rise because virtually all of the population growth that is projected for the next four decades is going to take place in the less developed regions of the world. And I would add here, Stuart, that that is a huge concern because developing countries tend to be the politically, the socially, the economically and the ecologically most fragile countries in the world. Also, I think it's interesting here, if you were to look at a list of the top 10 countries in the world in terms of population size, what you'd see is that there are three developed countries on that list today, those being the U.S., Russia, and Japan. But if you project forward and look at that list in the year 2050, only the U.S. will remain on that list. The other nine countries are all going to be hailing from the quote-unquote developing world. And as a side note here, India will overtake China as the most populous country on the planet. That crossover is projected for the year 2027, so in other words, less than two decades away.
Wow. Well, beyond the regional trends, I think in your review you also talked more broadly about the demographic transition, which you alluded to in terms of fertility rates and, I suppose you could say, extension of age or even declining mortality, perhaps. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of mechanics of the demographic transition?
Well, the demographic transition is a term that demographers use to signify a historical change from a regime of high mortality and high fertility rates to low mortality and low fertility rates. But in most countries, a key feature of the transition is that mortality rates decline before fertility rates. And the result of that is a transitional period of population growth. That is, of course, if you leave migration aside, the inevitable result of fertility rates exceeding mortality rate. So the notion of a demographic transition, as I say, it's a transition from high fertility and mortality to low fertility and mortality, but it's also a transition from low rates of population growth to high rates of population growth back down when the transition is complete to low rates of population growth again.
Well, let's look at some of the larger implications of some of the things we've been talking about. One of the things I got out of your review was that although people often tend to discuss rapid population growth in these kind of dire Malthusian terms, history suggests that population growth doesn't necessarily need to be catastrophic. Are there some specific examples of this we might look to?
I think what you're alluding to, Stuart, is a classic debate in the population field. It's a debate between what we call the population pessimists and the population optimists. The pessimists go back to the Reverend Malthus, the late 1700s, his essay on population, and he basically put forward the view that population growth proceeds exponentially and that it necessarily outpaces the growth of food production, and that as a result, human misery and suffering are inevitable. At the other end of the spectrum, there's another school of thought, the so-called population optimists, who believe essentially that necessity is the mother of invention, and that rapid population growth actually spurs technological and institutional innovations and improvements in living standards. Today, we realize that the rate of population growth is not the only demographic that's economically consequential. The age structure of a population is also quite important, and the population pyramid changes in very predictable ways over the course of the demographic transition with quite interesting implications. So all demographers learn in Demography 101 that mortality declines in high mortality populations are mainly associated with declines in infant and child mortality, and that's due typically to increased access to vaccines, antibiotics, safe water, sanitation. So at the beginning of the demographic transition, we tend to have this decline in mortality that is enjoyed mainly by infants and children. And what that does is it causes a baby boom. It's not the usual baby boom we're used to thinking about in which there are more births, but it's a baby boom that's caused by the fact that the babies that are born have higher survival rates. That baby boom ends when fertility subsequently declines, and fertility invariably declines as couples realize that they need to have fewer births to reach their targets for surviving children, and also as those targets are themselves moderated. Now, baby booms, it turns out, are very consequential economically because of the fact that lots of children means we need lots of resources to feed them, to clothe them, to house them, to provide for their medical care, their schooling, and so on. Those resources do not appear out of thin air. They have to be diverted from other uses, like building factories and laying down infrastructure, investing in research and development. And that diversion of resources tends to slow the process of economic growth, at least as we conventionally measure it. But then what happens is what I like to call the iron law of demography kicks in. And we're all painfully aware of that law because it tells us that with the passage of every year, our age goes up by one. And that's important here because it means that the baby boom that's triggered by the beginning of a demographic transition eventually reaches the working ages, and it's going to do that within somewhere between 15 and 25 years. And when that happens, when these large cohorts reach the prime years for working and savings, the productive capacity of the economy expands on a per capita basis. And I should also point out here that that period of time where we have the large cohorts in the prime ages, that can also be a window of opportunity for a great deal of social and political instability, especially in economies that don't generate sufficient jobs.
What about the other side of the age pyramid? I mean, the demographic transition presumably is leading to an aging population, and that would seem to be pretty economically consequential itself.
It's certainly true that eventually these large cohorts come out the other end of the population pyramid. And that's what the whole world is looking at right now. So today, there are 800 million people in the world age 60 and over, that being the what demographers conventionally refer to as old age, 60 and over. By the year 2050, so in just four short decades from now, that 800 million will be transformed into 2 billion people, representing more than a fifth of world population. On a kind of at the country level, it's kind of interesting to note that Japan has the oldest population in the world today. So 31% of Japan's population is age 60 and over. But by the year 2050, there are going to be 42 countries in the world that have larger elder shares than Japan has today. And by 2050, Japan's elder share is going to reach a historically unprecedented level of 42%. Now, what you're also getting at here, what are the implications of this? And here I would say that population aging is almost completely virgin territory for the world. We just don't have any historic examples that we can turn to for good indications of the implications of population aging, certainly at the levels we're talking about here, and for how to address those challenges and take advantage of any of the opportunities that are there. But it's not hard to understand the fears. But I would say, though, that in the end, it's unlikely that the worst fears associated with our graying populations will be realized. But the reality is that a great deal of analysis and debate and behavioral adaptation and policy reform, both in the public and private spheres, is going to have to take place before we can be sure that our worst fears are not going to be realized. The good news here is that we really do have multiple options for addressing the challenge of population aging. Just as some examples, we often talk about raising the age of retirement, or we can think about tinkering with Social Security contribution and benefit rates, or also we can expect rising rates of female labor force participation that are enabled by continued low fertility or higher savings rates for longer periods of retirement, or increased investments in health and education as a way to increase not the actual labor force, but the effective labor force.
Well, you know, listening to you and putting all of this together, it seems like we're looking at a very complicated situation here. There's the issue of different national experiences, the fact that, as you say, we haven't seen anything before like this population aging. Is there anything that can be said generally, sort of from a policy point of view, about how the world should be reacting to or looking at all of these shifts?
Well, I certainly agree with your assessment that the demographic picture is complex. And I would go even further and say that it poses some truly formidable challenges. But I wouldn't characterize those challenges as insurmountable. But we have to deal with them. And we have to deal with them not by continuing to stick our heads in the sand and neglecting things like the reform of retirement policy or the development of global immigration policy or the unmet need for contraception among hundreds of millions of women in the world, or the huge knowledge action gaps that we see in the area of child survival, for example. It's just plain irresponsible, I would say, to sit by idly while humankind experiences full force the perils of demographic change. And not only is it irresponsible, it's totally unnecessary. So I look forward to October 31st, 2011, when world population crosses the 7 billion figure, not so much as a millstone, but hopefully as much more something we look back as a milestone.
David Bloom, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Stuart.
David Bloom is the author of 7 Billion and Counting, a review article in this week's Population Special Issue of Science. You can find the full contents of the special issue, including news, reviews, and additional multimedia and interactive features at www.sciencemag.org/site/special/population.
As David Bloom noted, rising populations of young, working-age people can be a double-edged sword. They can boost economic activity and prosperity, but, say demographers, they can also lead to social unrest and violence in some societies. Mara Wiestendahl reports on the debate surrounding whether a youth bulge in population leads inevitably to conflict and instability. She talked with Stewart about the story.
The idea is that you can predict where conflict will break out by looking at what percentage of the working age population is young, not actually children, but looking at the group between 15 and 29. And so that's the group, they're leaving school, they should be getting jobs. And the idea is that when that group swells and when its numbers grow, that it's very hard to create employment for all of them and that they're particularly prone to unrest.
Okay, so that's the so-called youth bulge, I guess, that you talk about in your story. Just drilling down a bit deeper, how does one actually define a youth bulge and how does a society get there?
Well, actually, the political scientists and demographers who study this issue disagree slightly on how to define it. There are some people who say that you look at the proportion of 15 to 29-year-olds as a total of the working age population. And then there are others who look at it as a proportion of the total population. I'm told that there's not a huge difference in terms of the outcome, but there is some disagreement on how to define that bulge. But that term actually comes from looking at the age pyramid, what demographers call the age pyramid, where you graph a population by age group. Traditionally, it would form a pyramid with the youngest group, the children, forming the largest bar at the bottom, and then with older people at the top being kind of the point of the pyramid. And the bulge idea comes from the fact that when you look at pyramids in countries with a large number of young people, there's really a bump in that group.
So essentially the base of the pyramid is narrower than the middle, and the middle is broader than the top.
Right. Well, it gets even more confusing. In some countries, the base is also wide. So these demographers and political scientists are looking just at that 15 to 29-year-old group and then comparing it to the total number of adults, excluding 0 to 15-year-olds altogether.
So in this story, you tie this youth bulge particularly to the recent conflicts in the Middle East and North Africa and suggest that some demographers are saying that this is an outcome of this youth bulge in those areas and the social issues that accompany that. But presumably, if this is what's going on, it must have been seen elsewhere too. Have we seen other examples of this in history?
Well, the group that studies this phenomenon, they actually look at historical examples as well. And they say that youth bulges were responsible for everything from the English Rebellion in the 1640s, to some degree, World Wars I and II, which occurred at a time when there was a large number of young people in Europe. In the 1970s, they look at the Marxist revolts in Latin America and at the Iranian Revolution. So even in the U.S., to some degree, the 1960s, which was not a period of outright conflict, but it was a lot of turmoil happening in society. And also we had a large number of young people. So that's the idea.
Well, that's an interesting point, though, because that's kind of an eclectic group of examples. And if this is a real effect, then thinking about the causes, it seems in some sense like a real multivariable problem. You mentioned employment as one variable, but can we really pinpoint why a youth bulge might lead to violence and unrest? Are there other factors besides employment involved?
Well, there is a good bit of criticism of this theory for the reason that all of these other factors are involved. And now the political scientists and demographers who are behind the youth bulge theory, they say that these other factors are in fact related to the large number of young people. So that things like an overeducated population can happen when a country is developing and you have that large number of young people, then once those people get out of school, they have trouble finding jobs unless the government creates jobs for all of them. And so they say all these things are interrelated. The criticism is that it's not so simple. It's very hard to abstract all of these different factors into one unified theory. And so there's a bit of debate.
And presumably, if a country has a youth bulge, then over time that profile is going to change. People don't stay young forever. What happens then over time?
Well, so Richard Sincotta, he's a political scientist who studied this issue. He's at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. He proposes that when a country moves through that youth bulge stage, so when it gets to the point where the population starts aging, that it has a greater chance of achieving liberal democracy. and not just democracy in name, but he looks at the ratings given by Freedom House of countries around the world, and then has plotted those against the countries going back to 1970 who've achieved varying degrees of liberal democracy, and then looked at their age structures, and he's decided that there's a relationship.
So you mentioned at the outset that there's this notion that we can kind of look at a society's age structure and almost predict future episodes of violence or unrest from that. And you talk a little bit in your article about how it's maybe not, you know, quite as clean as that. Can we look at a society's demographic profiles and start to at least make some educated guesses? Was that your impression as we went through here?
Well, this idea that demography helps foretell conflict is a really old one, actually, going back to Malthus in the 19th century. Then the idea was just that a growing population would be a threat. And in the later, in the 1960s, then the idea became that population growth led to conflict over resources, and that that in turn would spark conflict. So that's an old idea. And one of the criticisms is that some of these earlier theories have not panned out, or that they've actually missed a number of the conflicts of the 20th century. And of course, technology changes, societies urbanize, you have all these other factors that come into play. But on the other hand, the youth bulge theory has worked, at least in the case of North Africa and the Middle East, in these recent revolts that we saw there earlier this year.
So we should at least keep an eye on populations of angry young men.
Well, that's an interesting thing as well, that you mentioned angry young men. Another issue is whether you're just looking at the overall number of young people or at the proportion of men to women in the population. There's another camp, and they're not necessarily opposed to the youth bulge camp, but there are people who say that gender inequality, the degree of gender inequality in a society, can play a significant role as well.
Well, you have another story in this issue about some societies that seem almost to be trying to create a youth bulge, in a sense, the so-called Asian tigers. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, the Asian tigers, so this is Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, and Hong Kong. And I don't go into Hong Kong so much in this particular story, but they're often grouped together. They achieved really rapid economic growth over the past 40 years or so. And one of the reasons that demographers give for that is what they call a demographic dividend, so that they had a large number of young people that they put into place policies that ensured that they were employed. And they really took advantage of that youth bulge. And then that's something that proponents of youth bulges acknowledge, is that this can also be an advantage if a country utilizes that group of young people. But recently, the economies have started to slow. Birth rates have dropped significantly to the point that these countries have some of the lowest total fertility rates in the world. And now the average woman is just having over one child. So there's been a huge effort now to increase that fertility rate and convince couples to have more children in East Asia.
And how's that working?
Well, it's a huge effort, trying everything from these group marriages where officials will marry hundreds of couples at once. Singapore has an official dating agency, actually, to set people up. It's not clear that efforts like those are having an effect. And what demographers really want to bring up the birth rate, you need to create an environment where people feel, you know, where it's family friendly in all kinds of ways, and just encouraging people to couple up, and in some cases paying them to have children, that's only a very short-term solution.
Mara Vistendahl, thanks very much.
Thank you, Stuart.
Mara Vistendahl writes about youth bulges, baby booms, and social unrest in the news section of this week's special issue.
As dramatic as it is, the current demographic upheaval isn't humanity's first. In a perspective article in this week's special issue, Jean-Pierre Bocquet-Appel of France's National Center for Scientific Research writes about the Neolithic demographic transition, or NDT, the transition that set the stage for all that followed. Bocquet-Appel spoke with me about the NDT from his office in Paris. He noted that after millions of years of very slow population growth for the genus Homo, a big change in demography occurred starting at the beginning of the Holocene, around 11,500 years ago, accompanying the shift from hunter-gatherer to agricultural economies. That demographic transition, he says, was kicked off by a major increase in female fertility.
First, in some regions, individual female fertility rose relatively quickly, from 5 to 7 children on average in just 2,000 years. But then, as population densities increased locally, the density of pathogens also increased, which in turn caused mortality to rise as well, within a few decades of the rise in fertility. During these few decades, the rate of population increase rose sharply, possibly to 1%, which is 100 times higher than during the earlier intergastral period, thus producing a rapid increase in population. There were children everywhere, and the average age of the population was 17 to 18 years.
Well, let me stop you right there, because that's very interesting. You essentially had this big increase in fertility, sort of accompanied slightly later by an increase in mortality, but that the net result was that there was a dramatic increase in population, and you started talking about the demographics. How have scientists been able to identify those demographics? What are some of the techniques used for that?
The amount of archaeological remains is approximately proportional to the size of the population that produced them. A small population leaves few remains. A large population leaves many more. Archaeologists have long noted a considerably large amount of archaeological remains, including villages and even cities in Neolithic Eurasia, corresponding to an agricultural economy. In comparison with the very few vestiges of the Paleolithic, corresponding to a hunter-gatherer economy. But the archaeological remains of villages and towns do not directly express demography. However, skeleton in cemeteries and their age distribution do reflect demography.
So that's skeletons in cemeteries that researchers are using to express demography?
Yes, but when we have those skeleton distribution, we need a paleodemographic reference grid to give a demographic meaning to the age distribution of skeleton, which could otherwise be misleading. For example, by analogy with a population in which there are inputs and outputs, in other words, birth and death, it will be natural to think that a cemetery is the output of a population and therefore represents mortality. In fact, anthropologists have shown that the cemetery mainly reflects the shape of the age pyramid of a living population.
Oh, I see. The shape of the age pyramid. So in other words, the relative distribution of ages within a population
right.
is what's being expressed in the cemetery. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, it is correct.
So let me see if I can take the next step. If in a particular cemetery you see a large proportion of young skeletons, maybe,
right.
you know, 5 to 10 years old, you conclude not necessarily that mortality was higher in 5 to 10-year-olds, but that there were just more of them in the population.
That's right. When the shape of the age pyramid has a lot of young, it means that there were a lot of young people in the age pyramid. And the mortality, in fact, is elusive.
So you can't actually see the mortality, but you can make statements about the fact that there was this demographic transition in the Neolithic.
That's right. As we have the fertility side of the NDT, the Neolithic demographic transition, we have applied to it the general population model, which is called density-dependent in ecology, or Malthusian in social demography, in which simply say that unless we accept that a population with a growth rate of 1%, will rapidly reach astronomical number, which means that is it doubles every 70 years, then rising birth rate has to be quickly followed by a rising mortality.
Mm-hmm. So that's, in essence, an inference that you drew from
right.
the rising.
Right. In a sense, this is an inference.
Yeah. Let's talk about the timing and abruptness of this. If I'm understanding your review correctly, it was a rather abrupt shift. What were the sort of things that were triggering this?
I think that life for human individuals involved various regular routines. Reproduction is one of these natural regularities, which it was instinctable to control, like feeding oneself several times a day, sleeping, menstruating, or defecating. The key to the demographic shift during the NDT, the imprinting unprecedented increase in the individual fertility of women stemmed from the transition from a nomadic intergastric economy to a sedentary agricultural economy.
So the transition, you said, from a nomadic to a sedentary agricultural economy, that was the same sort of larger pattern that we saw that almost in some sense defines the Neolithic. This also drove this demographic transition.
Yes, but more precisely, this is the energy balance, which changed considerably among farming populations, tending towards a significant increase in energy input, coupled with lower energy losses.
I see. So energy balances are the mechanism that are doing this?
Yes, that's right. To go from a forager economy to a producer one, tripled the amount of kilocalories for the same weight of food consumed.
Wow. That's rather dramatic.
Yes, this is dramatic. You're right. Plus, on the energy loss side, nomadic intergastra used up less energy as they became less mobile and settled in farming villages, where mothers could lay their children on the ground instead of carrying them everywhere, most often on their backs.
I see. So you write in your review that the NDT, the Neolithic demographic transition, was the mirror image of the contemporary demographic transition, which has been described, you know, obviously for Western industrial societies. Could you explain a bit what you mean by that?
Yes, with the NDT, the initial increase in fertility was followed a little later by rising mortality. This happened over 2,000, 3,000 years in the centers of agricultural invention and in 500 years or less around their periphery.
Mm-hmm.
With the CDT, these demographic forces are acting in reverse, both in their timing and in their direction. Instead of a rise in fertility, as in the NDT, we have a drop in mortality. This is followed by a drop in fertility within a relatively short time, 20 to 200 years in zones where it occurred naturally, and 50 to 75 years where it was intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And during these time lapses, the difference between birth and death rate for the NDT, or death and birth rate for the CDT, caused the sustained growth of the population.
Mm-hmm. And so in essence, in the NDT, you had enhanced fertility followed by enhanced mortality. In the CDT, you had a decline in mortality followed by a decline in fertility. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, that's right for the CDT.
Yeah. So let's step back now that we've sort of introduced the NDT and the CDT. Let's just step back and talk about the larger implications of what you're talking about in your review. This was obviously a huge event in the history of human populations. What does all this mean, both for the history of population and maybe about today's population challenges?
Seen in a long-term evolutionary perspective, the NDT, with the invention of the agricultural system, opened the door to the emergence of demographic masses, as well as the radical cultural changes. These masses brought a stream of technical innovation that correlated with the size of the metapopulation, colonized the entire planet, and are even now invading the oceans, the planet's last El Dorado, while 30% of the world's primary biomass is now dependent on the agricultural system.
So in some sense, what we're seeing in the NDT is simply the contribution of a huge number of people that made possible all of everything that followed. Is that one way to put it?
Yes, that's right. Contrary to the NDT, which was triggered unconsciously, the CDT, which was consciously initiated with the Enlightenment, is rapidly closing the demographic door that was opened wide by the NDT, and through which, like an invasive species, 7 million to 7 billion human beings have been moving. Unlike the young and probably turbulent metapopulation of the NDT, the metapopulation after the CDT will mainly consist of old, even very old, people whose existence, at least for the vast majority, is unlikely to be sustainable. After the CDT has closed the door opened by the NDT, the human metapopulation is likely to go into long-term decline.
Okay, well, Jean-Pierre Bocquet-Appel, thanks very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Jean-Pierre Bocquet-Appel writes about the Neolithic demographic transition in this week's Science. You can find the article, along with others in this special issue on population, at www.sciencemag.org/site/special /population.
Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here to fill us in on some recent stories from our daily news site. So for our first story, David, it seems like neurologically humans don't age nearly as well as our primate cousins do.
That's true. We actually titled this story The Incredible Shrinking Human Brain, and it's actually not far off. It turns out that we seem to be alone in the animal kingdom, or at least among other primates, in that our brains shrink with age, at least according to this new study.
So how did scientists figure that one out?
Well, what they did was they actually compared us to chimpanzees, or they compared the brains of a bunch of humans to the brains of a bunch of chimpanzees. Now, they weren't actually cutting any heads open for this. They were using MRI scanners, which can give a pretty good sense for how big somebody's brain is. And the reason they chose chimps is they wanted to see if there was some sort of evolutionary reason why our brains shrink with time. And they actually didn't even know going into the study that our brains really shrink that much. They just sort of suspected it because humans tend to have a lot of problems with their brains as they age. We develop Alzheimer's disease, dementia, other disorders, and these seem to be linked to a decreasing brain volume. But they wanted to confirm that, and they also wanted to see whether it really was a phenomenon that was unique to humans. And so that's where the chimps come in, because chimps, as you know, they're our closest cousins in the animal world. And so they only diverged from us about 5 to 7 million years ago. So if the same thing is not happening in chimps, this really means this is probably a very unique thing in humans. And that's, in fact, what the researchers found when they compared MRI scans of a bunch of chimps and humans of various ages. They found that the chimp brain doesn't really shrink at all, or at least not very significantly with age, whereas the human brain shrinks quite a bit.
So how much shrinkage are we talking about here?
Well, some of the regions of the brain, of the human brain, shrink by as much as 25% by 80 years of age. So you're talking about very significant shrinkage. And they also noticed differences between the gray matter and the white matter of the brain. Sometimes the white matter tended to shrink as much as 24%, while the gray matter shrunk about 14%. But all in all, they were just seeing pretty dramatic decreases in brain volume for humans, and they weren't seeing that for chimps.
So why do scientists think that this would have evolved?
Well, it's a really good question. Actually, one of the scientists calls it the million-dollar question in the article, because it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. You know, we live for a long time. We need our brains for a long time. Why do our brains start breaking down? And the answer seems to be that our brains consume a tremendous amount of energy. Up to 25% of our energy goes to our brain, even when we're resting. If you compare that to other primates, and it's only about 10%. So we're using a lot of energy. And when we're pumping that energy into the brain, just like you pump energy into anything else, it starts to break down over time. We're asking the brain to do millions of computations, just to do a lot of work and a lot of thinking for us. And over time, the cells that are involved in that are going to start burning out and breaking down, just as you expect might happen with any machine that you're operating for a long period of time. And the reason it seems to happen more with humans is just because we're using our brains so much, and potentially so much more than other animals are, that these other animals aren't necessarily feeling the ill effects of using their brain, even when they get really old. But it's just a hypothesis at this point. Researchers don't know the actual answer.
Are there any other animal species with longevity that we might be able to study this further?
It's a great question. And actually, species like turtles can live for more than 100 years. Elephants can live more than 70 years. And chimps actually don't live that long. They rarely live longer than about 45 years, which some experts have said is the flaw with the study, because it could just be that just chimps don't live as long as we do, so you're not seeing the shrinkage. So they say, you know, we should really start looking at turtles and elephants. Good luck getting an elephant into an MRI scanner, but that's definitely a possibility for future research.
Certainly. All right, next up, seems like dolphins are now tapping into electrical fields to hunt their prey.
Right. Well, from chimpanzees and humans to dolphins, this next story is about a new type of sense that dolphins may have that we didn't know anything about. Dolphins already have a pretty extraordinary sense known as echolocation. And this is essentially a sort of a sonar beam that they send out, and they can, over quite long distances, probe even beneath a sandy bottom. They can see fish with this echolocation sense. And other animals actually also have an interesting sense called electroreception. And that basically, as it might sound like, it's the ability to detect electric fields. And actually, we all give off electric fields. Just when we move around, when we digest food, the activity of our muscles and nerves give off these weak electric fields. And actually, some animals, like platypuses, can actually pick up on these electric fields and they use them to seek out prey. Nobody had suspected this could happen in the dolphins, and they didn't think the dolphins would even need this anyways because they've already got this great echolocation sense.
So what tipped us off that dolphins had evolved this trait?
Well, the dolphin the researchers worked with in this study is called the Guiana dolphin. This is a species that lives off the western Atlantic coast of Central and South America. They hunt fish in pretty muddy waters. And they also live in captivity. In fact, there is an aquarium in Germany that has a couple of these Guiana dolphins. And one day researchers noticed that these dolphins actually have these dark pits on their snouts. And these pits have been assumed to have been a bit of an evolutionary leftover. Researchers think that dolphins used to have whiskers that sprouted from these pits, but over time they evolved other senses. They didn't need their whiskers anymore, but they still have these pits as leftovers. Kind of like we have our appendix, but it doesn't really seem to be doing anything. And so what they did was one of the dolphins actually died, unfortunately, and they did an autopsy. And when they dug further deeper into these pits, they seemed to resemble the electroreceptors on other animals. But just because they look like electroreceptors doesn't mean they actually were. And so with the one remaining Guiana dolphin, the researchers actually did some experiments where they trained the dolphin to try to recognize an electrical signal. They basically put it in one part of its pen, and they said, you know, if you recognize this electrical signal, we'll give you a treat. They probably threw a fish at it. And indeed, the dolphins seemed to be able to pick up a variety of electrical signals, very low electrical signals, very high electrical signals. And when they covered the dolphin's rostrum, which is sort of like its beak, with a plastic cup, the dolphin could no longer pick up the electrical signals. So that seemed to be pretty strong evidence that these dolphins can indeed pick up electrical signals from their prey.
And why do scientists think that this species in particular evolved this system?
Well, like I said earlier, these dolphins hunt in pretty muddy waters, although you could argue that they would use their echolocation to get around that. But it turns out the echolocation works best at sort of more longer distances, whereas electroreception would actually work better at shorter distances. So if you're in water and you can't see very well and you've got a fish right in front of your nose, echolocation may not help you out, but electroreception might, and that might be why these dolphins have evolved this particular skill.
And lastly today, we've got 10-million-year-old drama at the center of the Milky Way.
Right. Well, we're now moving on to something completely different. Yeah, this last story is actually about the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And although it's a black hole, it's actually a pretty sleepy black hole. It actually hasn't been doing anything for a few million years. But we know that in the past, this was a very active black hole. Scientists have determined that there was just this firestorm of activity in this black hole about 10 million years ago. This black hole was emitting some of the highest energy radiation in the universe. So we know that although it's pretty dormant today, this black hole had a pretty active past, but we don't know why. And in this new study, researchers have proposed a very interesting hypothesis, which is that another black hole smashed into it and basically gave it a bit of an upset stomach, which is why it was so active millions of years ago.
So what led scientists to investigate this matter in the first place?
Well, there's three really interesting and kind of puzzling phenomena that are associated with the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. First of all, last year, astronomers discovered that there were a pair of gamma ray emitting gas bubbles, each about the size of a small galaxy, that were emanating from the Milky Way center and appear to be fueled by some kind of violent event at the core of the galaxy, but they weren't sure what it was. The core of the Milky Way also contains an unusually high number of newborn stars and an unusually low number of elderly stars. So the question was, is there something that could explain all this? And indeed, there may be, and that's where this black hole smash-up comes into play. Astronomers say that if a black hole from a smaller galaxy had smashed into the center of the Milky Way a few million years ago, a few things would have happened. First of all, the incoming gas from that galaxy would have fallen into the Milky Way supermassive black hole, and that's would have generated the bubbles of gamma ray emitting gas that astronomers detected a century ago. This gas would have actually been belched out of the black hole, sort of like a person eating after a good meal. And in addition, a new galaxy smashing into us would have actually seeded the center of the Milky Way with a lot of newer stars. And the gravity from this smash-up could have actually flung out a lot of older stars. So this scenario seems to explain a lot.
Are astronomers all in agreement that this is actually what happened?
Well, it's just a hypothesis at this point. It seems to explain a lot, but it really needs to be tested. Now, obviously, we can't go back in time 10 million years to figure out if this is actually happening, but astronomers can create computer simulations. There's some testable hypothesis as well. If a galaxy did smash into us, or at least into the black hole at the center of our galaxy, about 10 million years ago, it should have formed a ring or a shell of high-velocity stars a few thousand light-years from the center. And these could actually be picked up by the Hubble Space Telescope. So that's one thing astronomers could look for to help confirm this hypothesis.
So has there been any other belching coming from this black hole ever since?
Well, like I said, this black hole has actually been pretty quiet for at least a few million years. But astronomers say that this proposed idea, if it actually is true about a small galaxy smashing into us, could actually happen again. Billions of years from now, another galaxy could smash into us, feeding our black hole and giving it a reason to belch again.
All right, well, I'll have my 3D glasses on for whenever that happens. All right, well, what else have you been looking at this week?
Well, for Science Now, we've got a story about social networking in elephants. This isn't elephants using Facebook, but actually how they have much more complex friendships than we thought. Also, speaking of brains, we've got a story about how brain blast injuries, like those that happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, hurt the brain. What is actually going on there? For Science Insider, we've got a story about a surprising reversal from a federal judge concerning embryonic stem cells and what impact that's going to have on stem cell research in the United States. Also, a story about primate research in the UK and the ethical hurdles of working with non-human primates in labs over there. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, we've got a story this week about whether animals use language like people do. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that wraps up the July 29th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.